WHEN 106.9 Salida. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And tonight our guest is G. Edward Griffin. He's a writer and documentary film producer with many successful titles to his credit listed in Who's Who's in America. He is well known because of his talent for researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that we can all understand. He has dealt with such diverse subjects as archaeology and ancient earth history, the Federal Reserve System and international banking, terrorism, internal subversion, the history of taxation, U.S. foreign policy, the science and politics of cancer therapy, the Supreme Court, and the United Nations. His better-known works include The Creature from Jekyll Island, World Without Cancer, The Discovery of Noah's Ark, Moles in High Places, The Open Gates of Troy, No Place to Hide, The Capitalist Conspiracy, More Deadly Than War, The Grand Design, The Great Prison Break, and The Fearful Master. Mr. Griffin is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in speech and communications. In preparation for writing his book on the Federal Reserve, he enrolled in the College for Financial Planning located in Denver, Colorado. His goal was not to become a professional financial planner, but to better understand the real world of investments and money markets. He obtained his CFP designation, Certified Financial Planner, in 1989. Mr. Griffin is a recipient of the coveted Telly Award for Excellence in Television Production, the creator of the Reality Zone Audio Archives, and is president of the American Media, a publishing and video production company in Southern California. He has served on the board of directors of the National Health Federation and the International Association of Cancer Victors and Friends, as founder and president of the Cancer Cure Foundation. He is the founder and president of Freedom Force International. Well, good evening, Ed.
Well, good evening. I'm exhausted just listening to all of that.
I should have read it a little bit more before I got started there, but that's fine.
It's all there. In fact, there's too much of it. It's a testimony to what happens when you live long enough.
Well, at least you're out there, you know, fighting for the rest of us, getting the information out there. I don't even know where to begin because I didn't even realize that you had written all these other books. I have made myself familiar with, you know, your work on the Jekyll Island and the cancer and Freedom Force International. And I'm going to let you, you know, get started with possibly on the Jekyll Island issue.
Well, okay, I can do a brain dump on that pretty well, I think. The book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, is all about the Federal Reserve System, and a lot of people are curious as to why it is such a strange title for a book about the Federal Reserve System. Well, I had a couple of clever reasons for naming it that way. One is that if you want to sell a book in the marketplace, you better have an interesting title. So The Creature from Jekyll Island at least meets that criterion. But the other thing is that I thought it would attract attention. The creature, having that word in there makes it sound like it might be the creature from the Black Lagoon. And Jekyll Island is reminiscent of the word Dr., or the title Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is a very mysterious story. So I thought it might attract attention of people for that, thinking maybe this was a sequel to Jurassic Park. And but the real reason is very practical, and that is that the title has a great deal of significance. The Federal Reserve System was actually created back in 1910 on Jekyll Island. It's a real island, and it's off the coast of Georgia. And it was on that island in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was created. It was not only created there, which is strange enough because you'd think that something like the Federal Reserve might have been created in Washington, D.C. It has the image in most people's minds of being a government agency, which it isn't. I'll get to that in a moment. But I thought it was curious when I discovered that it was really planned and laid out by a small group of men on Jekyll Island back in 1910. And now, Jekyll Island in those days was privately owned by a small group of billionaires from New York City. People like J.P. Morgan, William Rockefeller, and their business associates. This was a place where the families of the super wealthy of that time, they went there during the winter months to escape the rigors of cold weather in New York City and thereabouts. And down there in Georgia in the winter months, it's pretty nice. And so they bought this island. They built their summer mansions there. Well, actually, winter mansions, I guess, in this case. Although sometimes they did go there in the summertime. But then they also built this magnificent clubhouse, which is, all of this is still there. You can visit the island today. Back in those days, you had to visit it by a ferry boat. But now there's a bridge. The island is owned by the state of Georgia. I don't know how they got the taxpayers to pick it up, but they did.
Really?
And it has been maintained now, and it's offered to the world as kind of a historical monument and a tribute to these people. It's still a resort area. Okay, so, well, anyway, back at Jekyll Island, and so it's kind of a tribute to the super wealthy of that period, and an example of the architecture of the time. It's quite an interesting place to visit. But that's a little bit of a side journey in our main path here. The significant thing is that the Federal Reserve System was created at that clubhouse on that island.
This is Eric Carlstrom and Ed
Hello, Eric. How are you doing?
Hello.
Okay, he was talking about Jekyll Island right here, so over here.
Okay, well, I'll just pick it up.
Through
your reference there, Eric, I had just talked about the fact that the Federal Reserve was created on Jekyll Island back in 1910.
Yeah.
And so I was just describing the island and the people who owned it, the billionaires from New York.
J.P. Morgan, I believe. Is that right?
J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business associates.
Yeah.
And it was a place where their families went to escape the cold weather from New York City. It's a beautiful place, and today you can visit it. In those days, you had to go by ferry boat, but today they have a bridge to the island, and it's still a resort island, but it's open to the public now. And they have tours where you can go visit the mansions that these people had built in those days, and they're really quite nice. The people called them, in those days, they called them cottages, but you and I would call them mansions. And one of the interesting things about them is that in those days, bathrooms were pretty rare. If you had one bathroom in a house, you were pretty upscale. So a lot of these mansions had more than one bathroom. That was very a big event in those days. But the significance of the story here relating to the Federal Reserve is that there was a magnificent clubhouse that they built. And remember, this was a private club for the super wealthy. So they really went all out in the construction of this clubhouse. And that, too, is still standing. You can visit it, and you can have lunch there. I think it's run by the Marriott Hotels today. You could even check in to one of the rooms that these people might have used, the ones that didn't have mansions or cottages there. So it's quite an interesting historical journey in time. But for our purposes, the real story is the fact that the Federal Reserve System was created on this island in that clubhouse rather than in Washington, D.C. And I thought that was kind of strange when I discovered that. And so I started to dig deeper into it. I went to the island. I visited the museum there. I talked to the curator of the museum, the very nice ladies that kept all the historical records. And we dug into the filing cabinets, and we came across photographs and private letters and newspaper accounts of the time and so forth. It was kind of very exciting to dig into this original raw history. And what we find is that this meeting was conducted under conditions of great secrecy. It's a fact that there are many wars of history were conducted under conditions, or plotted, I should say, under conditions of less secrecy than this meeting. And I thought that, too, was strange. Why would these people have any desire to keep that meeting secret? So the more I dug, the more I discovered that the men that went to that island, and there were seven of them, they met in private in November of 1910. They assembled in the private railroad car of Nelson Aldrich, Senator Nelson Aldrich at the time. He was one of the men. And this was at the New Jersey's Hoboken station. And they were told to come in the evening separately, not to be seen together, not to dine together the night of their departure. They were warned to avoid newspaper reporters at all costs, because in those days, a lot of newspaper reporters hung out in that station. It was the place where they knew that all of the politicians and celebrities and other dignitaries would assemble. If they wanted to go anyplace, generally they wouldn't fly, but they would go by train. And so they all went to that station, and so all the paparazzi were there waiting for somebody to show up. And so the men who went to that meeting were told to avoid those reporters at all costs. One of the men carried a shotgun in a big black case, so that he was just prepared to tell these reporters, if they should approach him, that he was going on a duck hunting trip. And it's kind of funny about that, because we find out later from his children and his biographers who wrote about this event that this man never fired a shotgun or any other kind of a gun in his life. Didn't even own that shotgun. It was borrowed simply for the purposes of deception and a decoy.
You kind of get the feeling that they knew that they were doing something that was might have been a little clandestine.
Well, Melody, that's the whole point. The more of these facts that I came across, this question began to well up in my mind. What were these guys trying to hide? When you do something in secret, it's because you don't want others to know what you're doing. I thought, why not? What's wrong with a bunch of people getting together any place they wish and drafting legislation for the Federal Reserve System? It's curious they want to do it there, but that's okay. I don't care where they do it. I discovered finally what it was. I finally found out what the skeletons, what closets the skeletons were in, who they belonged to. It's a real whodunit mystery. That's the point of all this. But let's cut to the chase. What was it that they wanted to conceal? The purpose of the Federal Reserve Act, as it was advertised to the American people, the reason the American people and their congressmen accepted it is because they believed and they were told that it was a means of controlling the banks. Now, the big bad bankers in New York on Wall Street had made a very bad name for themselves. And the American people were concerned over the great concentration of wealth and economic power that was in the hands of a small group on Wall Street, these investment bankers and insurance companies and commercial banks and so forth. And so there was a clamor to draft legislation which was going to put Congress in charge of these big bad bankers. And they called them the money trust in those days. If you go to the newspaper accounts of the period, go back to the microfilm, you can roll through the editorial pages and you can see time and time again where they refer to this group of financiers as the money trust. And during the political campaigns, there was a lot of traction gained on the platform of breaking the grip of the money trust. That was a phrase that was very popular in those days. And so the Federal Reserve System was offered to the American people as a means of breaking the grip of the money trust. It made it very popular.
So the people that were very much creating that money trust were the ones creating the answer to it?
Well, that's the whole point. When you look at who these men were that went to that meeting and drafted the Federal Reserve System, they were the money trust. They represented the money trust. And so this was a classic case of these people are not stupid. They knew that there was a clamor for some kind of legislation which was going to control their power. Did they sit back and wait for it just to happen and accept the consequences? No. They're too smart for that. They said, okay, the people want legislation. Let's draft it ourselves so that it won't do at all what they think it will do. It will advance our position and our strength but we'll tell them, the people, that this is just the opposite. And so they had to meet in private. If the public had known who those people were that actually drafted the Federal Reserve, why, the scam would have been out in the open.
And if I could interject here, Ed, this is perhaps a classic case of the Hegelian dialectic, where they set up a problem and they then a reaction and then they propose the solution. So again, it's a scam. It's a way to manipulate people, and it's done on the basis of stealth and deceit. And I guess we could find many other examples in history conducted by the same money trust, as it were.
Well, not only in history, it goes on every day.
Yes.
In fact, I don't think it's ever been more blatant than it is today. Everything you look at in the news today, every time we have an excuse for expanding the power of government, and that means expanding the power of the people who are actually astride of the government, who control the government through lobbying activities and financial donations. Let's face it, in the real world in which we live today, and this all started back in 1910 with the Federal Reserve, but it's a continuum, there are people behind the scenes who have much more influence over our elected representatives and over our courts and over our police systems, much more power and influence than the voters. And it's something that American people have got to wake up to. And this all started at the turn of the century with the Federal Reserve. And so we see it time and time again where these people want to expand their power and they want to have an excuse for expanding the power of government and selling it to the American people as a solution to a problem of some kind. So all they have to do is just convince the people that there is a problem, and usually there is. They don't have to, you know, make that up. It's a problem that's caused by these people, but then they say, here's the solution, and the same people that caused the problem advance the solution, and it perpetuates and intensifies the problem.
Excellent. I would don't want to derail us and send us in a different track, but I personally, teaching physical geography, I think global warming may be an example of something like that, where this is a problem created by industrial uses of fossil fuels, which these guys are in charge of, and then they tell us it's a huge problem, and oh, by the way, we'll have a solution, which is going to be carbon taxes and more control by government, etc.
Of course, it's a classic example, and everywhere you look, everything that we're afraid of environmental disaster, we're afraid of terrorism, we're afraid of crime, we're afraid of drugs, we're afraid of pornography. All of these things are used as scare tactics. They're real in most cases, but they're certainly used quite skillfully and blown up, if possible, out of proportion, very convincingly, and scare the dickens out of the American voters who just accept any expansion of government as the solution, and meanwhile his own personal liberty and his freedom and his privacy is retreating down to the zero level.
Yeah.
And he's happy about it because he's being protected.
Because he's safe, yeah.
He's safe, yeah. And that's the process. Well, all of this was very evident back in 1910 when these guys met on Jekyll Island. And so the American people wanted to be safe from these big bad bankers. So the big bad bankers are the ones that went to Jekyll Island and created the legislation that was sold to them as a measure of giving them economic safety. So there you have the reason for the title of the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and the reason that these bankers did meet in private on Jekyll Island.
Ed, if you could just answer a question for me. This book, The Creature of Jekyll Island, when did this come out? What was the year?
Oh, let me think. I think it was 1997, I think, was the first edition. We've got three editions and 20 printings now, and I might add that that's quite an amazing thing to me because I didn't think that this would be a book that very many people would want to read. I just wrote it because I had this need to. When I discovered all of these things, I thought, my gosh, let's get this documented and in print. But much to my amazement, a lot of people have been interested in the story. And, of course, as economic conditions become more and more hectic today, it seems like that the interest level increases.
Now, there have been some other books on this general topic, one by Eustace Mullins called Secrets of the Federal Reserve, which which I think came out in the 50s, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And then Anthony C. Sutton's book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, must have come out in the 80s or something like that. So you were building on their work to some extent, is that right?
Well, there's no question about it. I stood on the shoulders of these people. A lot of them did the real pioneering work in bringing these facts to the front. But, in fact, I dealt with that issue in the beginning. Why would the world need another book on the Federal Reserve when, in fact, there were scores of them? And I read, I guess, most of them by that point, and I decided that the thing I could contribute to this story was to broaden its scope a little bit, to give some history behind it, to show that the Federal Reserve phenomenon was not a unique thing. It was part of a historical continuum that goes way, way back to the origin of banking itself. And I wanted to show how it tied in with other issues, especially wars. And also I wanted to give it a little bit of a flair of a novel, because when I looked at this story, I didn't see it so much as a technical issue of how money comes into existence, what they do with the reserves, what the ratios are, and all of those things, which, because there are a lot of technical issues in this story. But I wanted to sort of skip over those, because to me, the action was in the whodunit aspect. I saw this whole story as a detective story, a mystery story, a whodunit. Well, I found out who did it, what they did, how they did it, and so forth, and so I wanted to give that little bit of a flair to it, to make it more interesting. Because indeed, I think this is one of the most interesting stories of all history. And if you could compare this to something you'd make up as a fictional novel of some kind, this is more interesting than any novel that I have ever read. So yeah. That's the reason I decided to do it.
So it's not a conspiracy theory, it's a conspiracy fact or a conspiracy reality. Would you say that?
Well, yes, I would, except that, some people have trouble with the word conspiracy. It doesn't bother me at all, because if somebody scoffs at the conspiracy and they want to call something a conspiracy theory, I kind of have to laugh at them, because that means they've never read a history book.
I came to that conclusion myself.
The fact is, history is built on conspiracies. All the great events of history, if you look at them carefully enough, you'll find not just one, but probably many conspiracies at the time, and they go on all the time today. Just go to any courtroom and sit there long enough, and you'll get case after case of conspiracies of family members trying to conspire to cheat some other family member out of their inheritance, conspiracies in the corporate world, conspiracies everywhere. Anyway, so some people laugh at, and they call these things conspiracy theories. Well, I also have a bit of fun asking them what they mean by a conspiracy, because once you do that, you find that generally they can't even define the word.
Yes.
The fact is, a conspiracy, according to most dictionaries, is an event that has to have three qualities to it. First of all, it has to be conducted by two or more people. And secondly, it has to have a goal which is either illegal or immoral or unethical. And thirdly, it has to be done secretly using deception and or coercion. Okay, that's a conspiracy according to most dictionaries. In this case, the Federal Reserve System, we're talking about certainly two or more people, so check that one off the list. They are using deception and coercion, because they use the force of law, which is coercion, and deception has been present from the very beginning. The fact that this whole meeting on Jekyll Island was conducted in secret, and people denied, that the ones who attended denied that they even went to that meeting for many, many years. So deception is present from the beginning to now. But that leaves the third area, which is where we have a little bit of a problem. It is what they are trying to accomplish, or in this case, what they did accomplish, is that illegal and or immoral? Well, it's certainly not illegal, because the whole purpose of the Federal Reserve Act was to make it legal. What they planned to do became legal when they got Congress to enact the Federal Reserve Bill. So it's not illegal. What about unethical or immoral? Well, in their minds, the people who did this and who run the system today, they think it's the highest morality. They think it's a means of preserving a system banking system that in their minds is very efficient, and although it has some problems and some people suffer and some people lose their savings and inflation wipes out everybody at the age of 72, all of those things, they still say, well, if we didn't have this system, we'd be living in caves eating raw meat. So in their minds, they think that what they're doing is ethical. Now, so that just leaves it up to us. Do we think what they're doing is ethical? Most people think that because they don't know what they're doing. But when they find out what the system really is and how it works and the effects it has on us, then most people say, well, this is not ethical at all. So the people who are engaged in this program do not think it's a conspiracy, but for us who have to live under the consequences of their acts, I think it's a very appropriate word.
Would you have you explained exactly what they accomplished when they got this bill passed in terms of changing the banking system in their favor?
Well, what they accomplished was, first of all, we have to be very clear as to who and what they are. What did they create? And then we can take a look at what they accomplished. The Federal Reserve System, as I mentioned earlier, appears to be a government agency. This is part of the deception aspect of this whole thing. They went to great lengths to give it that appearance. They called it federal, to make it sound like it has something to do with the federal government. They put the word reserve in there to make it sound like it has reserves of some kind. Well, first of all, it's about as federal as FedEx, and it has no reserves, any appreciable reserves. And they put the word bank on it. Well, it's not a bank. A regulatory agency, and altogether they make it look like a government agency because it was enacted, created by a congressional piece of legislation, given the powers by Congress, but it's not a federal government agency. It is a cartel, and that's the shocker when you really analyze it. The Federal Reserve System is a banking cartel, no different than a sugar cartel, oil cartel, banana cartel. This happens to be a banking cartel. It's a grouping of the major banks in the United States that came together, and they said, look, guys, let's quit competing with each other. Competition is a sin, old Rockefeller said. All of his biographers quote him on that. He said, competition is a sin. He didn't mind competition as long as it, you know, moved him and some of his buddies to the top of the industrial mountain. But once they got to the top there, they didn't want any more competition from others, and so they set about to get government involved, to pass laws, to regulate the industry so that they themselves could determine what was proper, what was legal, and what everybody had to do in the industry. And they did this primarily to prevent competition against their own positions. So the Federal Reserve is a cartel, and they went into partnership with the federal government in order to require all of their competitors and their partners to agree to the cartel or to conform and abide by the cartel agreement. See, one of the problems with cartels and monopolies, well, cartels in this case, is that you can come to an agreement with your competitors. And let's say you're an oil cartel and you say, okay, we're going to fix the price of oil at $100 a barrel so that our profits will be a little better for us. And nobody's going to cut that price, right? And they all agree, right, we're not going to cut the price. Well, then a little bit down the line, let's say Mexico decides they need some money. And so they said, no, we're going to break our cartel agreement. We're going to lower the price of oil to $85.50. That way we get more sales, we'll make more money, and we need the money. And there's nothing that the other cartel members can do to discipline Mexico or any other country into abiding by their original agreement, unless they have some kind of a law. Now, at the national level, this is very simple. If you get your cartel agreement all wrapped up the way you like it, then you bring in your politicians, you grease their palms, you give them nice investment options, you make them rich, and then they will pass laws for you so that the agreement, the cartel agreement, now is a federal law. It's offered to the American people as a means of protecting them. And now when the members of the cartel break the agreement, they go to jail. And that's the reason cartels like to go into partnership with governments. Now, at the international level, I might just add that, you know, if you've got Mexico versus Venezuela versus the United States versus Russia and so forth, all having a cartel agreement on oil, and one of them breaks the agreement, who is the policeman? Well, there's only one place to go, and that's to the international level. That's why we now are seeing all of these international agreements, like NAFTA, where you get all of the nations into an international structure of some kind, and then the laws are passed at the international level, supposedly to regulate trade and benefit the peoples of the world, and that's how it's always sold. The truth of the matter is it's merely to regulate industry. It's to regulate all of the producers of the world so that if they break the cartel agreement, now they send in the United Nations peacekeepers, or they arrange some kind of a internal revolution, revolt of some kind, and they topple the governments that no longer comply with the cartel agreement. And they do this with international military force.
And this is done regularly.
It's done regularly, and it's an amazing fact that the public can look at this and stare at it blindly and not really understand because they're so enamored with the phrases that are offered by the politicians. That, oh, this is done for international trade. This is done to expand our borders. And they throw all the nice, fluffy words that make you feel all warm inside, but when you really look at these... effect of this international legislation, you realize it's just a means of putting more chains and handcuffs on the workers and on the producers of the world.
That's very well expressed. I've heard it said that Confucius, when asked how to fix the problems of the country, he said, rectify the language. And I think what even then, thousands of years ago, perhaps he noticed was that if you allow the leaders to distort the meanings of words, kind of in the sense of George Orwell, like free trade means something exactly the opposite of what it is, national security means exactly what the opposite of what it is, etc., and you get the people to believe that, then you have you've established your dominance just through confusing people.
Well, yes, these are psychopolitics that are at work here. I mean, there's no greater example of it. Let's say the Patriot Act. It's the most unpatriotic thing you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
But the people chew their gum and they accept it. And so that's a real problem we have, and it raises serious questions about the survivability of our system. And that's another issue, but anyway... got off the track. All of this was certainly in evidence back in 1910 on Jekyll Island when the Federal Reserve System was created. Well, that was the beginning. 3 years later, the Federal Reserve Act was actually passed into law. And so it took them 3 years to sell this. They conceived it first, then they had to sell it to Congress and to the American people. It's a pretty easy thing to do because they used all those nice words that we were just talking about.
But was it ratified?
Of course, it was passed by Congress in December.
Okay, because I thought I'd heard that they didn't ratify it, but I guess I didn't.
Oh, yes, they did. Now, some authors have made a rather big deal out of the fact that it was run through Congress just before Christmas and not too many people were there to vote on it. I think that's significant to the extent that not too many people were there to debate it or talk about it. But the voting, it was pretty well determined. Most of those congressmen and senators were already on record as supporting the bill. So had they been there to vote for it, they would have anyway. The sales job was very good. It was done very thoroughly. You see, some of these people who designed the Federal Reserve Act, the well-known bankers, after they did that, they started giving speeches before banking associations, knowing that they would be reported in the press. And they gave interviews to newspaper reporters, and they started to condemn the bill that they had written themselves. They started to say, this is going to be bad for business, going to be bad for America. We can't have these controls on the banks. And of course, the average guy reading that in the newspaper would say, hey, Maude, listen to this. These big bankers don't like the Federal Reserve bill very much. It must be pretty good. You know, this is the kind of brilliance that these people have. And those kinds of tactics were used to sell the Federal Reserve Act.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, Melody, I think what you're talking about when you say it wasn't ratified, I believe there's a lot of people saying that the 16th Amendment, which provides for federal income tax, was never ratified by two-thirds of the states.
Okay, and that might be what I'm thinking of, right?
Yeah. But that has something to do with this, because if you're going to create a debt money system in the control of private hands, you have to have a way of collecting on the debt, and that's what the federal income tax did. So it comes out about the same time.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the same people that created the Federal Reserve Act, the same banking consortium, the same financial groups, were also behind the creation of the federal income tax, and it was in the same year. You know, these people were very busy that year, 1913.
That was the 1-2 punch, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely. And, of course, I'm not an expert by a long shot on the income tax, but I do know that it was sold to the American people as being in their best interest. It was sold as a means of making those wealthy people, those nasty wealthy people, pay their fair share. That's how it was sold. And the average voter, responding to kind of a gut level of resentment against the super rich, envy and resentment, said, yeah, we need a bill like this to make these people pay their fair share. Meanwhile, the very super wealthy had already gone to work writing the laws and creating the loopholes so that they didn't pay their fair share at all. And it all played out, and now we see that the middle class has been wiped out by the Federal Reserve System and the income tax working jointly.
Isn't this also about the time that they started doing non-governmental organizations for their charitable, utilizing that as a means to hide their earnings, or do I have that correct?
Melody, I think that the non-governmental organizations are a fairly recent development.
Okay.
I'm going to guess that those started to come into action within the last 15 years or thereabouts.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think what you're talking about, Melody, is the foundations.
Okay,
where the Rockefeller Trust was supposedly broken up by the antitrust laws of Roosevelt. What they did is they figured out a way to get large amounts of their money into these private foundations, which basically just protected their investments anyway.
Yeah, these fellows and their attorneys figured it out quite well long ago that ownership is not as important as control. The only reason you want to own something is so that you can control it. Well, if you can control it without owning it, that's even better, because that means nobody can take it from you. And you can make it look like you're a big philanthropist because you gave it to some foundation or to some trust. And what people don't realize is that the board of directors of that foundation or that trust are all employees of yours.
Right.
That's basically how it works. And so they have the great philanthropic trusts, and like the Carnegie Foundation and the Rockefeller Fund and all those things. And people say, oh, gosh, that's wonderful that these wealthy people gave away all of their money. Well, they didn't give it away at all. They just put it into tax-exempt, which means tax-free, organizations, which they totally control just as though it was in their own private pockets. So that's the reason that the Federal Reserve System and the income tax were created, is to allow these people to continue to control their great wealth and have great influence over politicians and over society in general, and not be so visible with it. They're now behind this cloud or this mirror, smoke and mirrors of it looks like they're just philanthropists, when in fact they just have more power than ever before.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, so you're telling the story quite well, thank you, about what they created. And now could you explain a little bit how it works for their benefit?
Yes.
And against our interests.
Yes, I started down that track a little while ago and got sidetracked.
Right, right.
Yeah, I wanted to establish that this was a cartel that had been had gone into partnership with the federal government, and that's what we're dealing with the Federal Reserve. But now, having said that, the question is, well, why would these two groups go into partnership? There must be a benefit for each of them. And so now, to see what that benefit is, we come to the issue of how money is created. So let's start with the federal government side of this partnership. Why are the politicians interested in this? Well, aside from the fact that they have been financially rewarded by the financiers to support the legislation, they also have practical political reasons, even without the financial reward, personal financial reward. And it's in the in this issue of deficit financing. Politicians have learned that the best way to get elected, to appeal to the public, is to give them benefits. Politicians are always talking about increasing benefits. They're going to have more Social Security, better health care, better roads, you name it. They're going to give the people benefits. Well, those are expensive. And they've discovered that if you pay for those benefits through taxes, well, then you undo what you did by offering the benefits, because people don't like high taxes. They want benefits, but they don't want to pay for them. They want somebody else to pay for them. So politicians like to increase benefits, but they don't like to increase taxes to pay for them. So how do they get the money? Well, they get the money by borrowing it, just like you and I would. If we want to spend more than we take in income, we have to either borrow it or steal it. Well, that's another issue. A lot of times that, well, actually they are stealing it, as we'll see in a moment. But it looks as though they're borrowing it. So here's how that works. They go to the public and they say, well, we want to float some government bonds or treasury bills or notes. We want to borrow money from the public to pay for the increased benefits. And a lot of people step forward and say, sure, well, we'll lend money to the government. That's a good bet. It's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, and they pay interest on it. What could be better than that? They don't think it through. They don't realize what that phrase means when a debt is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. What that really means is that the government surely does promise to pay you back, plus interest. They promise to do it, come hell or high water. If they have to take everything from you that you have in order to pay back that loan, they're going to do it.
That's a heck of a deal.
It's a great deal, most people think. So they don't realize that the reason that their taxes are going up and that inflation is eating them alive is because of the full faith and credit of the United States government. So anyway, the government does borrow a lot of money from the private sector in this way. Not only the private sector, but from banks and institutions and from other governments all around the world. But notice that this does not expand the money supply at all. All this does is borrow money that already exists and creates a promise to repay plus interest. That does not expand the money supply yet. It happens that when the interest comes due, the government is still spending more money than it was taking in taxes. And so how can it pay back what its previous loan was plus interest? That's no problem for politicians. They just go borrow some more. This time they borrow enough to pay back the earlier loan plus the interest plus additional spending. And so year in and year out, we have this phenomenon of the national debt growing and growing and growing. The truth of the matter is, when you look at it, that the politicians do not expect to ever repay that debt. That's the reason this thing goes on and on and on. In fact, they never will repay it. The whole system will be destroyed before anybody could be repaid. And they know that. Well, some of them don't know it, I suppose. They just are playing along. But if anybody has 2 cents worth of brains, they can figure it out that this debt cannot just grow forever. And there's no way, there's no ability of the American people to be taxed enough to pay back that debt. It's going to collapse. But anyway, the point is that we finally come to the point where the government cannot borrow enough from the private sector, and they need more. Now, this is where the Federal Reserve System comes in. Now the government goes to the Fed, and it says, look, we need another $1 billion today. And the Federal Reserve says, okay, no problem, and they just hand them a check. Well, actually, it's done in computers, but to visualize it, let's say they hand them a check for $1 billion, and the federal government takes it and deposits it into its checking account. Now it has another $1 billion to spend for benefits. arises, well, where did that money, that $1 billion, come from? What account? Who put the money into the Federal Reserve System so they could give it to the government? And the answer is nobody. There is no account. There is no $1 billion. They just create it out of thin air. It's something that if you and I were to do, to write a check without any money behind the account, we would go to jail. But they can do it because they're in partners with the government. And the Federal Reserve Act makes it entirely legal for them to do that. And it's something very advantageous to the politicians because they know that when push comes to shove, if they cannot get enough money from the private sector at the rates they're willing to pay, they can go to the Federal Reserve and get any amount of money that they need for whatever purposes they need it for. And the Federal Reserve, by obligation, because it's a partner in this deal, will create that money and give it to the government. It's the same as if the government turned on the printing presses and just started rolling money off the presses for whatever amount it needs. It's the same thing in essence, but it's more difficult to understand because it's all wrapped up in the mystery of the banking system. And most people don't understand it at all. They don't realize that money is just being created out of nothing. And frankly, they don't care, many of them, because they don't see how it impacts them. We'll come to that issue in just a minute. So that's the beginning of the process. We see now why the politicians are interested in the Federal Reserve, because it's kind of a safety net for them. They can get money at any time. All right. That's just the beginning of the cycle. Now we turn to the question, why are the banks involved in this partnership? And if you think the creation out of money for the government was interesting, you ain't seen nothing yet, because now this is where the action heats up. Let's take, let's say, $1,000 that was created out of nothing by the Fed for the federal government. And let's say that the government gives a $1,000 check to the person that delivers our mail. Okay. The postal worker has a $1,000 check. He takes it down the street to his private bank, his commercial bank, and deposits it into his banking account. Now the action is out of the Federal Reserve government cycle and into the banking cycle, and this is where it gets really interesting. If I were the president of the bank where this postal worker deposited the $1,000 check, which yesterday didn't exist, there was no money yesterday at all, but today he's got $1,000. If I were the president of this bank, I could, if I wanted to, go to the window there at the bank and address everybody in the bank, and I could say, attention, everybody, I have good news. We have money to loan today. This gentleman over here just deposited $1,000 into our vulnerable bank. And you might, if you were there, you'd say, well, that's good, but I need more than $1,000. I came here to borrow $9,000, and I guess you don't have it, because all you got is that $1,000. And I could say, well, don't worry about it. We can take care of that. You might say, well, how can you do that? You've only got a $1,000 deposit. And I'd say, well, sir, don't worry about that. The Federal Reserve System has set up rules and regulations for your protection that allow us to create the extra money. The Federal Reserve requires that we keep 10% of all of our loans. We keep it in reserve just for emergencies because we're very conservative. So this gentleman has just given us $1,000. We'll put that under a column in our books, and we'll call that a reserve. So now we have $1,000 reserve. $1,000 is 10% of $10,000. We've got $1,000 in reserve. That leaves $9,000 that we can loan. And you might say, well, wait a minute. Where did the extra $9,000 come from? And I would have to say, well, we created it. We just created it out of thin air. The $1,000 is our reserve. We're entitled to loan another $9,000, so do you want the loan or not? And you might say, well, okay, give me the loan. So that means that for every $1 billion created out of thin air for the government by the Federal Reserve, now the commercial banks can create an additional $9 billion out of thin air and push it into the economy in the form of loans to you and me and businesses and so forth. So that is how money comes into being in the United States and in most places in the world. It's literally created out of nothing, and it's put into circulation in the form of loans. If all of the loans that exist were to be called back or paid back by the borrowers, that all of that money would disappear back into the vaults, back into the inkwells, back into the computer chips from which they came, and there would be not one penny out there in circulation, because absolutely 100% of all of the U.S. dollars out there were created initially as a result of a loan to somebody. And so the banks are able to collect, now get this, interest on nothing. And now you see, if you just ponder that, why the banks are in it and why they like the Federal Reserve System so much, very much. Thank you.
And they didn't have that process before?
They did have that process before, but it was not institutionalized nationally. The same arrangement that I'm describing, and I was going to call it something a little more severe, but let's just call it an arrangement, existed prior to the Federal Reserve System at the state level. The banks had made similar arrangements with the state politicians in all of the states of the United States. And this led to regional problems. Banks were going bankrupt. There were runs on the bank in Michigan, and then there was one in Tennessee, and so forth. They would have these regional problems. And so they decided one of the purposes of the Federal Reserve, actually, one of the things they discussed on Jekyll Island, is how to bring this all together to make it a national phenomenon so that we could avoid those regional little booms and busts. We could spread it around to the whole nation. So if Tennessee had a problem, we could draw on the resources of the rest of the states to come to the aid of Tennessee. And that was part of the rationale. So in other words, they institutionalized this thing so that now you don't have regional booms and busts. You have national booms and busts. And so, yes, definitely they did have the same thing prior to that.
And also, didn't they borrow the whole idea of the system or take it more or less intact, verbatim, from the Bank of England and the City of London?
Exactly. The Federal Reserve System was modeled 100% on the model of the Bank of England. There's no question about it. And they called that the central bank. That's still the word they use for it today. And one of the things they discussed on Jekyll Island is how to sell this without calling it what it really was. By that time, several congressmen and senators, like William Jennings Bryan, who was a very well-known senator at the time, was very concerned over the fact that this was being modeled after the Bank of England. And he and others were saying, you know, this is the United States of America. We don't want to bring over the old world policies to this country. We are unique. We need our own banking institutions, and we certainly don't want a central bank like they have over there. So on Jekyll Island, they pondered this, and they said, well, we want to create a central bank, but we can't call it that because these people are onto that. So what do we call it? So they called it a Federal Reserve System. That's not a central bank at all, you see, because the words aren't there. Well, anyway, yes, you're quite right. They did model this after the Bank of England. And what we really are dealing with is a cartel of the private banks, which have formed a partnership with the governments of the nations within which they operate. And they have received, through law, a franchise to create the nation's money. When you think about that, a group of private banks have been given a franchise, a monopoly, to create the nation's money. Not too bad a deal.
You got to have a monopoly on making money. No wonder they could get very rich, huh?
Oh, yeah, that's it, in a nutshell.
If I could make $1 billion, I could be a billionaire, but I can't. Is that right?
No, you can't make money because you'd be thrown in jail as a counterfeiter. Unless, of course, you decided to take maybe 15 or 20% of that $1 billion and pay off the politicians first. Then they would write a law for you to do it, and you and they would both get rich. Meanwhile, the American people, people of any country, are paying terribly, a terrible price for all of this. The price shows up in the form of inflation, the rising prices for everything. As the money supply expands through this process, its value goes down. We have this phenomenon of rising prices. The prices really aren't rising at all. What's happening is the value of the dollar is going down. And there's no better example of this than to think in terms of the buying power of some commodity like gold. Money used to be based on gold or silver. You know, in those days, the purchasing power of the dollar was very stable. You could tell that if you had a dollar today, it would purchase as much or more when you retired than it did today. It made it very worthwhile to save. And there's no better example than to think in terms of ancient Rome. If we had lived then and had a one-ounce gold coin, we could have bought a very nice toga, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of sandals. That was the price in ancient Rome. Today, thousands of years later, if we take a one-ounce gold coin like a Cougaron or an American Eagle and we convert it into Federal Reserve notes and quickly go to the store before it loses value, we can take that money and buy, for 1 ounce of gold coin, we can buy a nice suit, a handcrafted belt, and a pair of shoes. The price of those things has not changed in thousands of years when based on something like gold or silver or anything that's tangible, anything that requires human effort to produce, because that then keeps pace with all of the other products and services in society that take human effort to produce. It's an automatic regulator, keeps them in pace with each other. But when you base a monetary system on pure whim, on a decision made by a committee of politicians or bankers, then the train starts to run away. Because if you can create money out of nothing, you know what you're going to do? You're going to create more and more and more of it, because there are agendas, your agendas, that can be quite well satisfied with more money. So whenever this happens in history, and it has happened a lot, the temptation has always been so great that politicians and bankers cannot resist it, and they create more and more money. The money supply expands at a rate much faster than the expansion of goods and services. Therefore, the value of the monetary unit goes down, the prices go up, and the middle class is wiped out. And that is what's happening before our very eyes today.
Now, this is KHEN 10LP FM, and 106.9 Salida, and today I have with my co-host Professor Eric Carlstrom, and my guest is G. Edward Griffin. Go ahead.
Can I jump in and ask a quick question or two here, Ed? As I understand it, the Constitution gives Congress the right to print the money. So, and this has been done a couple, three times in American history. So I guess if that's the case, and this group of secretive conspirators managed to take that right away from Congress, we really can call it a conspiracy, because it really is a crime.
Well, yes, it's hard in this case to figure out who committed the crime. I guess both parties did.
Okay.
But we have to go back to what the Constitution really does provide for. There's nothing in there that says that the Congress cannot print money, but printing needs to be further defined. If what you're printing is a piece of paper that represents a warehouse receipt, if the piece of paper says, this is good for 1 ounce of silver or gold or whatever it says to the bearer on demand, then it's perfectly legal money. The Constitution really gives Congress the right to coin and regulate the value of money. That's the phrase that uses, to coin money and regulate the value thereof. That simply means, just as the word suggests, to create coins of precious metals. Now, you might argue that it could mean other things today, and that's certainly a good argument. But in those days, it meant one thing, and you don't have to wonder about it. Just go to the constitutional debates that took place at the time the Constitution was written, and you see very quickly that's what the founding fathers meant when they talked about coining money and regulating the value thereof. That merely meant that they could determine that a dollar, which was the official monetary unit of the country, was so many ounces or grains of pure silver or gold or whatever they wanted to say. That's regulating the value thereof. They could determine what the value of the precious metal was behind the word dollar. But also the Constitution is very clear in that it prohibits the issuance of money based on credit or debt. And that is what our system is today. See, the people that drafted the Constitution had lived through their own lives, had lived through two terrible periods of destruction of monetary value, two periods of great inflation. Prior to the American Revolution, the colonies had discovered the printing presses. It's an interesting fact that the colonial America was the first place in the world where governments began to actually print money off of a printing press without anything behind it. The printing press was fairly new in those days, and European governments were a little hesitant to take such a bold step. But colonial governments had no hesitation. Boy, they were just printing money left and right. Everybody thought it was a wonderful idea. Look at this. We can print our own money. And so, consequently, the value of that money went down, 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 and people were wiped out who held money, which was most of them. And so they lived through that once, and then they came to the American Revolution, and they couldn't raise enough money from the colonists in the form of taxes to pay for the war, so they started to print money again. They call those the Continental Dollars. And they also finally wound up to be totally worthless, and people were wiped out who were dealing in those paper dollars. So when it finally came time to draft the Constitution, these men were very much aware of that history. They had lived through it themselves, and they said, the government that we are creating shall not base its money on credit or debt. In other words, they shall not create money out of nothing as a promissory note, an IOU. And that's very, very clear. Congress did not have the power to do that. The states did not have the power to do that. So lo and behold, all the people who lived then gradually got old, died. Another generation came along, got old, died. By the time you got to the third or fourth generation, people didn't remember that experience anymore. And the textbooks didn't talk about it very much anymore. So now, along comes the Federal Reserve and all of the bankers and say, let's have a monetary system based on IOUs. And people weren't reading the Constitution anymore. And so the Congress passed a law which was totally against the Constitution that gave a power which Congress itself did not have. They gave that power to the Federal Reserve System cartel. And that's the system we live under today, which is not authorized by the Constitution at all. And nobody's had the guts to challenge it. The Supreme Court has never heard of this case and will not hear it because it's too unpopular, because the Federal Reserve is too strong. It's too much astride the political system, and so that's the dilemma we're in today. By abandoning the Constitution, by abandoning the wisdom of our forefathers, we have gotten into a mess where we are today, and we're going to see the American dollar just completely tank. And the people who created this problem will then come along with the solution. They'll say, ah, boy, that dollar sure got bad, didn't it? I wonder how that happened. And they'll say, however, we now have the solution. It's called the Emiro. It's a new monetary unit. And it's part of a regional government which we're creating in which the United States will be phased out and absorbed into a regional North American Union, including the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And it will have its own monetary unit. We'll call it the Emiro. And now we have solved your problem. And people will be happy because their problem is solved by the same people who created the old problem. And then the Emiro will find out as time goes by, also is fiat money. It also does not have gold or silver behind it. It also will expand in quantity, and prices will go up, up, up as the value goes down, down, down. But the only difference is when this comes along, there'll be fewer currencies for investors to go to. Right now, if you're an American investor, if you don't like what the dollar is doing, you can buy the yen, you can buy the mark, you can buy the euro, you could even, you know, buy peso if you wanted to. Most people wouldn't want to. But now, when we get to the Emiro, that means that the choices will be fewer. You can be able to buy a euro or exchange your Emiros for euros, and that they are working now on creating similar monetary units for Asia and Africa. So there'll be about four currencies to choose from. And then after that, and by the way, they'll all be doing pretty much the same thing. They're all fiat currencies, so they'll all be going down in value, wiping out the middle class as they go. But then finally, somewhere down the line, probably in about 20 years or 15 perhaps, then all of those currencies will be phased out and merged into a central world currency. I have no idea what that's going to be called, but it's definitely on the drawing boards.
I think I have seen the name. It was something like a DAI or... I can't remember the name of it, but it was something along that line. I have seen it.
Well, now, Ed, when you wrote your book in 97, were you forecasting this progression then?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so this script was more or less available to you through your reading.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
this isn't something that a person can just make up. This comes from the writings of the people themselves who set all of this in motion back in 1910.
Yeah. If I could just kind of jump into the middle ground. We've gone back to the Constitution. We've jumped ahead to the Amero and a one-world currency. But at the present, we have, from what I understand, we have, again, this consortium of banks, this cartel of banks, which is the Federal Reserve, is now part of a larger consortium of banks called the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And from what I also which wields even more power, especially power to destroy the economies of third world countries. And we also have a situation now. I'll just leave it right there with the World Bank and the IMF. Could you talk about how that fits into this?
Well, yes, the structure is in place. It's not functioning completely yet, but it's in place so that as the world currency develops, that will become the center. Right now, there's another group called the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland that also plays a role, but it's hard for an outsider to know where the lines of control and authority are. I think the IMF and the World Bank are pretty much secondary to the central banks of the world right now because they depend on the national central banks for funding. They get their money from the separate nations. So that evolution has not completed yet, but I think what is going to happen down the line is that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund will become the central bank of the world.
And from what I understand, all of the 190 countries in the world, except for about five, do have central banks that are more or less along the same lines of our Federal Reserve, Rothschild, City of London-type controlled banks. And those five countries included rogue, quote-unquote, rogue nations like, for instance, the Axis of Evil, quote-unquote, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Is that correct?
Yes, that's very correct. And if you're a country and you go upstream against this method of funding and this international network, you're going to be in serious trouble. You will be labeled rogue. And I'm not defending any of these countries because I think they have serious problems, but I don't see their problems as much different than many countries which are not labeled rogue. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In fact, some of our closest friends in our network seem to be doing pretty much the same thing as the rogue countries. But it does point up the fact that if you get in the way of the international banking cartels, you are going to be facing a very hard opposition in the media and in the realm of military operations and certainly in the realm of economics.
Where does this all play into the oil bourses?
Well, the oil, we're looking at the same piece of wood, but just cut along a different angle, so the grain looks different. It comes from the same tree.
Uh-huh.
The banking consortia are very closely tied to, and in some cases you can't tell the difference between them and the oil consortia.
Okay.
The same people keep showing up.
Well, and not only that, but as I understand it, the deal that was cut right after World War II between American oil companies and say, Saudi Arabia and some of the other Arab states was that we'll buy your oil, but we get to set the price, and you have to pay in dollars, and you also have to pay for some of our debt. You have to pay our bonds. So this put a kind of a under the table alliance between the major oil producing states and the United States, and it guaranteed that all oil transactions would be made in dollars or petrodollars, which is really what has kept our economy on top of the world. Is that not correct?
Yes, I think that's very correct. These Arab nations primarily have this obligation, and of course we're seeing that unwind right now, but for many, many years they were buying our bonds with all their profits, which means they were bailing us out.
Right.
The inflation that should have hit the United States because of this rapid expansion of the money supply for all of these years was exported to those countries. And even though they were very, very wealthy, and I'm not saying they weren't making a lot of money, but a lot of their earned wealth from the sale of oil was being turned back to the United States because they had to buy our government bonds and invest in and use American dollars as the transaction currency, and losing value on it every day. So, that's what they meant primarily by exporting America's debt, is that we were getting so many nations to demand our dollars, which if they hadn't done that, inflation would have been triple or quadruple what it was in the United States.
And from what I understand, Iraq and Iran in particular, which are some of the very top oil-producing states in the world, have moved in the past few years to wanting to denominate their oil transactions in euros rather than dollars, which, of course, puts them in the targets of the American military.
Yes, of course, and I think Iran has already done that. If I understand it correctly, they've already declared that they're not going to use American dollars anymore. And they're free to use whatever they wish, but it's not going to be American dollars. And so naturally, now they're very rogue, and we have to attack them because they are a threat to the world.
So when you got started with the doing this book, how did it lead into what you're currently doing with the Freedom Force International?
Good question. I don't know that there's any particular event or milestone along the way, but it's just a gradual awareness, Melody, dealing with problems like this. And believe me, we just touched the surface here. So many problems in so many areas. After a while, you're swimming in these problems, and you say, well, what is the solution? Just knowing about these things is important, but it's not enough. How are you going to change the world? How are you going to undo this sort of thing? And that led me finally to focus on this thing called Freedom Force International. And I'll just address that issue briefly, because it's a huge topic. Maybe some other time we can go into it in detail. But
that would be great.
The conclusion I came to is that the collectivists, and that's the word I prefer to use for these people, the collectivists who are running the world today, and I know that sounds like a very like a conspiracy theory, but it's a fact. They do this not because of their sheer numbers. There are not so many of them, really. But they do it because they control the power centers of society. Now, that's a phrase that needs to be understood. That these groups actually write books on this sort of thing, and they hold schools and classes, and they teach people how to dominate the masses, how to lead the masses. And they use the phrase power centers. They recognize that human beings have a herd instinct. We follow leaders. We belong to organizations, call them power centers, where we respect our leaders and we tend to move as groups, like herds do. And so we belong to labor unions. We identify with political parties. We read our favorite newspaper, watch our favorite network news, and so forth. These are all power centers that lead public opinion and eventually determine the policies of the nation. The leaders of these groups are able to sway the masses because of the structure of power centers in society. And it turns out that these collectivists have focused on the power centers of society for many years with the goal of capturing control of them. And so they have found that if they can put one, two, or three people at the head of an organization, then they can control hundreds, if not thousands, of others because of the mechanism of this power center, which they control. And I observed that. And I suddenly realized that that was the missing link for our opposition to them. We have looked at what they do and wrung our hands and said, oh my, look at this, look at that, look what they're doing, we must stop this. And the general cry has been, well, write a letter to your congressman. And realize that these congressmen are the problem, most of them, not all of them. But, you know, writing a letter to the congressman, or getting another book and reading it, or going to another seminar and learning more about the problem is not going to change anything. We have got to recapture control of the power centers of society if we ever expect to turn this around. And the more I thought about that, the more I realized that that was the missing link for all of these years. The reason that most of us who've been in this awareness and this battle have not really accomplished anything is because we have no power. We're always on the outside of the halls of power looking in, saying, oh, please, those of you in there who have power, won't you please listen to us? Won't you please obey the Constitution? Won't you please do what is right? And, of course, they laugh at us, we who have no power. So the whole purpose of Freedom Force International was to come to grips with that issue and to organize people around the world who have a similar view of freedom, so that we can help each other go into the power centers of society and, to whatever extent possible, become influential in them, so that we can become the leaders that others will follow. That's the purpose of Freedom Force, and we now have members in 55 countries. So this is not just an American phenomenon. This is something that's truly global, and it is an idea whose time has come. And I urge anybody who wants to become a change agent, that really wants to do something about changing this world, not just complaining about it, to come to our website and check it out. Read what we have to say. I think you're going to like it. And the website is freedomforceinternational.org. Org stands for organization. So that's freedomforceinternational.org. Be prepared to spend some time there. I think you're going to like what you see.
That's great. It's a great idea. How many people do you suppose are participating at this point in this organization?
So the actual number of our members is the only secret we have. That's for strategic purposes. We're not as big as we would like, and so we don't reveal our numbers. Once we're in the millions, we'll be bragging about it.
I see. Okay.
But I can tell you that we count our members in terms of thousands. I mean, this is not just a little organization. But we're not a million yet.
Well, I certainly am interested to check out the website. I think you've got the right idea, and I think you've got the right diagnosis for why a relatively small group of people can control the direction that the world goes in, because they are so well connected, and they do control, as you say, the power centers of society.
Well, that's it, and it didn't happen overnight. When they started this plan, which was about the turn of the century, when they began to get organized primarily in England, a lot of this happened through the Fabian Society. That's where the roots of all this began, the turn of the century. You know, they had no control. They had no power. Their people were very wealthy, and some of them were placed in high positions, but they had no plan. That all started about the turn of the century. So it took them 100 years to do what they've accomplished. And that points up something very interesting for us who are planning to take back these power centers. We get impatient, don't we? We think, why? How are we going to do this by the next election? You know, that's our worldview. 2 years or 4 years at a crack. No, it's going to take longer than that. And so people get discouraged that, oh, if you can't do it in 2 years or 4 years, forget it. And that we ask that our members have the long view of history. What we're trying to do is not going to happen overnight. But, boy, it's happening, and it will happen. And that's very encouraging to me.
Well, this gets into another question to me. I've read a lot of books about this, and I'm looking forward to reading your book about the creature of Jekyll Island. I've certainly heard of that. But, you know, I've read about the history of the Illuminati and the Skull and Bones and various secret societies that go back 200 and 300 years, and others that may go back even farther, the Masons, etc. And what you see if you start to get into this reading is that this is a intergenerational plan that has been carried out over decades and centuries. What gives it the strength to maintain itself over that long a period? Do you have an impression on that?
A really good question, Eric. I've thought about that a lot. And I can only think of a couple of candidates for an answer. One is, and some people claim that there's an occult base, that this whole thing digs way, way down to perhaps a satanic mentality or a worship of Satan. I don't know about that, but it's a possibility. I do know that there's something there, and that could be one of them. Another possibility is that these people are really quite idealistic in their own way. They really believe in the creed of collectivism, that mankind is too stupid, that people cannot be trusted to run their own lives. Certainly they can't be trusted to run governments, that they're selfish, that they're stupid, and so forth. And so somebody has to run things for them. It might as well be us, the enlightened ones. And that has, I think that's a lot of logic behind it, because I do know that when people get a good education and they start seeing some of the deeper currents of history and culture, they begin to have a great deal of disdain for the common man, and they think, God, how are you going to let that person vote? That those people have a determination in world affairs. So there's a tendency to have a little bit of intellectual pride there. And so I can see that as a possible answer. And then there's another possible answer, which is that these people really become the rulers of society. And that's pretty heady stuff. There's a great deal of immediate reward for them, both financially and culturally and society. They're the leaders. They're the big dogs. They ride around in the limos, and they're the people that everybody bows to. And so that's pretty heady stuff, too. So I think it's one of those three, maybe a combination, maybe all three. I don't know.
That sounds like a very good answer to me. I think all three sound indeed compatible. Power. The attraction of power. I have an uncle who was very high in the CIA and wonderful guy, and we'll sit around and talk about, how you rule the world.
Yeah.
And he'll tell me, well, you do this and you do that, you know. And I'm thinking, well, this guy thinks he's God, you know. What's the deal here? You know, and he's a nice guy, and he's a favorite uncle and everything, but there is a lot of pride there, you know, to think that you are qualified to play God. It blows my mind. There's a lot of hubris there.
Yeah, and they feel, well, somebody's got to do it. Might as well be us.
Yeah, exactly. I've heard that one, yeah.
I am. They're in the club. Boy, we're members of the club. That's good.
I found on your site you had the report from Iron Mountain on there. And I happen to have that book, and I thought it was kind of interesting because, or you make reference to it, and I found that interesting because even in the preface to the book or whatever, they talk about it being a hoax. And would you like to address that at all? Or?
Well, first of all, I think your listeners might want to know what the report from Iron Mountain is.
Okay.
And I haven't looked at the dates in quite a while, but I've forgotten when it came out. But
it was in the 60s. 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. It was, in the 60s. Well, anyway, it was supposedly a think tank study that was conducted in Iron Mountain. Where's that? I've forgotten what state that is. I need to bring my phone up.
New York or something like
New
that.
New York, yes. It's it's a think tank study that brought together some of the intellectuals of the United States to discuss the issue of how do you, if you are in charge, how do you stabilize society? And so that had a very nice sound to it. This is worthy of discussion. Well, when you get into the book, you find out that the word stabilize society, as they meant it, was how do you keep the people from overthrowing their government? how do you keep the people subservient to the government, regardless of what the government does? That's what they meant by stabilizing society. So now that has a little different flavor to it. And so they discuss, well, how do you keep people subservient to the government and live under harsh conditions and not revolt?
Well, part of the title of it is the on the possibility and desirability of peace.
Peace, yes.
Right.
Well, that peace in that case means no revolution, no overthrowing the government, no challenging the government. That's peace, according to them. And they came to the amazing conclusion after studying all the things that can be done. They came to the conclusion that war was the best way to do that, to embroil the nation in a war, or many wars, and keep the people so frightened for their own personal safety that they will accept any absurdity of the government and rally behind their glorious leader in this effort for national survival and security. And that was basically the theme of the book. And so it was offered as a think tank study. And then finally somebody came along and said, well, no, this was not a hoax at all. This is the real thing. And then you get into that debate that was it really a think tank study or did the author simply dream it up as a dramatic way of explaining what was going on in the world? And all of that is secondary to the fact that the strategies laid out in this book are unfolding today.
Right.
Whether it was a real think tank study or the product of the mind of one man who wrote the book really is immaterial. When you see the blueprint spelled out there and then lay that as a template over current affairs, you can see that they match 100%.
You know, there's another document that also could be said, for which that could be said, and that is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And that's also somewhat controversial. Is this a forgery? That's been maintained it's a forgery. And yet, if you look at, it's hard to read. It's so diabolical, this particular book. But if you look at it, it does seem to be an apt description of what's going on in the world.
Well, that's true. In fact, if anybody's interested in my views on that,
I am.
I have done an analysis, and you'll find that posted to our Freedom Force website.
Oh, good.
Yes, and my conclusion after looking at that at some length is that it is a forgery. But as you said, also it's an accurate template of what's going on. But that leads to the second thing, which is that who wrote it and why? And it appears to me that it was written as an accurate template of what's going on in the world, but done in such a way as to throw suspicion away from the true perpetrators, which are the secret societies that we're talking about, to make it look like it was a Jewish conspiracy.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, instead of having people look for the true origin of all of this, they're looking at a group which is pretty easy to vilify in many parts of the world, especially in the days when that was written. It seems like the Tsar deliberately encouraged that because he wanted to make it look like the opposition to him was primarily coming from the Jewish community, which indeed it was. There was no question about that because the Tsar was pretty anti-Semitic, and the Jews didn't like that, and so they didn't like the Tsar either, and they were not very subservient to the regime. A lot of interesting things in that history, but I've got it all, at least my view of it, you'll find it on the Freedom Force website in the issues section.
Well, don't you find that, okay, when you were saying that in order to be able to deal with what's taking place today, you still kind of have to know what is the design behind it, and being Iron Mountain or Agenda 21 or whatever, unless we're aware of these documents and what's in them, we don't really have the full picture. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, it does. It certainly does, and it's not that complicated. Amazingly enough, when you stand way back from this painting, it's a huge painting, stand way back, and all of a sudden you realize this is a mural. And you can finally see it if you get back far enough, and the pattern is clear. And that is that from the beginning of time, there have been men who wanted to rule the world. And there have been different methods devised for that. for a long period of history, it has been decided that men would rule other men through superstition and through the appearance of them being the gods, representing the divine. It's still going on that way in theocracies in the world today. People rule others in the name of God. But historically, that went on for a long period of time. And then there was a period where men ruled other men through the force of arms, through the sword. It was pure conquest. No excuses. Hey, we conquered. You're our slaves. And then, in the 19th century, early 18th century, a new concept began to evolve, and that is ruling men through their minds, brainwashing them, convincing them that they are well served by being ruled, that it's really to their best interest, that they are their own rulers, as a matter of fact. But the arise of this concept of so-called democracy, whereby people are given the illusion of participating in their own political destiny. They go to the polls and they vote. They think, oh my gosh, I voted. So therefore, whatever happens now, I can't complain because I voted for the dictator. And the people want him. And so this whole thing of the people and democracy has become the final phase in this world rule. And that's what's unfolding before us today. People are being ruled primarily through their minds.
Right, but they still didn't stop the war or the slavery. I mean, isn't that what debt is?
Well, yes. But they're doing it themselves, you see. It's not being forced on them.
Okay.
Nobody came in with a bayonet and said, here, borrow money.
Very clever.
They came into their living rooms through television and said, wouldn't you like this nice new car? And so then they get into debt slavery that way. But anyway, it's all done through the mind primarily. Now, they've never given up the sword. That's always in the background. If necessary, they'll use it. But basically, if you look back at this mural, you'll see that this is always the same thing. It's a relatively small group of people that are trying to rule the world. And they're getting pretty darn close to it today.
Well, of course, you're probably familiar with some of the documents and literature and movies that talk about one of their goals as being depopulation of the world's population down to, you know, from 6.5 billion down to 1 or 2 or even less. Do you think that they are close to achieving that goal?
I'm hung up on the word close. I think that's certainly their goal. And that brings up so many issues in my mind. Most of us, I think, tend to agree that there are too darn many people out there, you know, especially if you live like I do in the city. Those out in the country don't have that feeling. But anyway, a lot of us think, yeah, why so many people? There ought to be controls. But what's happening in the world is that populations in advanced societies are decreasing. And they're not decreasing necessarily because of genocide. Even though people are dying of cancer more and more, they're taking longer and longer to die from it. So the longevity keeps going up. That's kind of an interesting phenomenon in itself. We get sick earlier and live longer. So we live in this prolonged state of illness, which is very profitable to the pharmaceutical industry, to the medical industry.
Right.
But we actually are living longer. So that would tend to push up the population statistics. But in advanced countries, like the United States, if you just take the people who were born here and don't count the immigrants, the population of the United States would be going down. And so it points out something to me that's very significant, is that you don't need master planners to come in and do things by coercion of law, such as forced abortions or sterilization programs or something like that. You don't need those things for population to stabilize. And nevertheless, the master planners think that is an area for their control, and they're very active on it in this kind of a field. And I wouldn't doubt at all that some people in those groups have have worked very hard on creating designer diseases or plagues or something like that to reduce the population. It's entirely within their mindset.
Yes. Well, as I understand it, they had a nickname for Scooter Libby, who was indicted, you know, in the Valerie Plame case. They called him Germ Boy because he was always talking about this, you know, new pandemic around the corner and whatnot. But I think this is part of their mindset to figure out ways to reduce the population.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So what I noticed that on your site you had something that got into the chemtrails a little bit. What is your feelings on that?
Okay, I'm probably one of the least qualified people you'll run into to talk on that topic. But that never has stopped me from expressing an opinion. And so I label it clearly as an opinion. The things we were talking about before, I think I can back up pretty well with research and documents that come from original sources and so forth. But in this area of chemtrails, my opinion is that we are being sprayed. First of all, to me and to my logic, what we're looking at up there in the sky, definitely impossible, is not at all a contrail. Sometimes you can see contrails, and I've even on occasion seen a contrail in the same sky with a chemtrail, and they're so different.
Right.
A contrail is a trail of vapor behind a jet aircraft flying at a high altitude, where the water that's coming out of the engine hits the cold air, turns into ice crystals, and you can see the vapor trail moving right along behind the airplane. It just it stretches out for, well, if you put your hand up into the sky and measure it with your thumb, probably would stretch along about two or three thumb widths behind the plane. And as the plane moves, the vapor trail moves with it, and gradually it just evaporates into the air, and it doesn't leave behind anything except this little moving trail of white wispy of crystal. Then you compare that with a chemtrail, where you see these things crisscrossing the sky from horizon to horizon. That thing never evaporates. It billows out. It joins with similar trails next to it, and gradually, after a few hours, the whole sky is milky. And there's no question in my mind that this is not a contrail. These are chemicals being sprayed into the air. And now the question is why. I haven't the foggiest idea. I think that eventually someone who is in a position to prove that these are chemicals will come forth and say, yes, these are chemicals, and I was involved in the project, I was the chief coordinator, or I was in charge of seven pilots, or whatever. Somebody's going to come forth, and it'll be acknowledged that, yes, these are chemicals. And when that day happens, I'm sure these people are going to say, well, we did it for you. We did it for you people. We know that the global warming is dangerous. We know that the planet is warming. And so we are spraying in order to reduce global warming. Or they'll say, well, we did it for you because, you know, we're living in times of terrible danger. There might be a biological attack. And we can't inoculate everybody against biological terrorism. And so we're using the spraying in order to use the debris that filters down. People will breathe that, and it'll protect them against biological terrorism. Whatever they come up with, it's going to be something that will be for us to make us feel, oh, isn't that wonderful that they did it? No, I don't think it's whatever it is. I don't think it's wonderful, but I cannot tell you what it is.
Well, do you find that? I mean, the more I look into the issues, that it's being able to understand the psychology that is being perpetrated on us is really helps to have a basic knowledge of that so that you can kind of recognize it?
Well, yes. The basic trick that they're always using is to scare us, number one, and then offer whatever they're doing as a means of protecting us against what we fear. It's very simple. And then we're grateful for it. I mean, the war on terror was no better example. We're scared of terrorism. And so now, terrorism, why do we are afraid of terrorism? Well, because they're going to kill us, or that these terrorists are going to somehow take away our freedom. So since we're afraid of losing our freedom to the terrorists, we are so grateful when our own political leaders take away our freedom.
See? It's like a protection racket from the mafia, isn't it?
That's it, exactly. It's Al
Capone,
it's a protection racket. Yeah. And I don't care whether it's terrorism or pornography or crime or drugs or global warming. You just go up and down the line. All of these things to be afraid of are used to make us feel so grateful when they come along and pass another law to protect us against those things that we fear.
So on your site, I notice you get into issues and you know what you're about and some of the activities. I guess what I'm trying to say is, how would you summate where a person would go and start educating themselves and then doing something about it?
Well, Freedom Force International is designed to be the answer to that question.
Okay.
It's not primarily an educational organization, although we do have a lot of information there that serves that function. But it's primarily for people who have a pretty good idea of what's going on in the world and who want to do something about it. That's the focus, activism, recapturing control of the power centers. Until we do that, then nothing is going to work. We can have all of the ideas in the world. I get so tired of reading my emails at times. I mean, I get, you can imagine, hundreds and hundreds a day. And probably 50% of them have to do with little editorials from well-intentioned people who say, we must do this, we must do that, we must stop this. You know, sure, how is the question? How are you going to do this? And the answer is you must have power to do any of those things. And they don't think about that. They just think of what should be done without any question of how to do it. We come to the question of how. And the answer is we must recapture control of the power centers of society. Until that happens, there is never going to be a solution to this problem. So let's get on with the job.
Well, here's a question for you, Ed. Now, if we go ahead and we capture control of the power centers, will not there be a temptation for us to become just like them?
Bingo. You bet. And we spend a lot of time dealing with that issue. That's one of the reasons we have what we call the Creed of Freedom, a clear statement of principles in which we believe, so that, you know, there's nothing more common in history than people rising up against some hated tyrant. And at the great cost of treasure and blood, they finally overthrow the tyranny. Lo and behold, they find out that they've replaced it with one just as bad, or
right,
even worse. That happens over and over again in history. And it's because people know what they don't like. They can see that. That's the tyranny they face. But they have no concept of what they want to replace it with that's any better. They always think it's a personality contest. They think if we can just get rid of Adolf Hitler because he's a bad man, then everything will be fine. We'll replace him with a Joseph Stalin, right?
Or a George Bush.
Or a George Bush, yeah. See, they have no idea of principle. They're always looking at people, with personalities, and they think that that's the problem. Well, it's not the problem. The problem is the system. The system that encourages corruption and tyranny. And the system is collectivism. I don't care what you call it, communism, fascism, Nazism, communism, I don't care what you call it. When you peel off the labels and look at the ideological mechanisms underneath, you find it's always the same thing. It's collectivism. We spend a lot of time on our website talking about that, defining it, giving examples, so that when people sign on to Freedom Force, they know exactly not only what they oppose, but what they promote, what they want. And the concepts of the kind of a system we're trying to build would absolutely prevent us or anybody else from becoming corrupted by the system. Because the thing that corrupts people, and we're no exception, I mean, you and I probably are corruptible under some circumstances. It's hard to imagine you, but maybe me. But that's human nature. And even if we weren't, we're going to die someday. We'll be replaced by someone who will be corrupted. So we have to look at the system. And so what we're trying to do is build a system whereby the concentration of power into the hands of an individual is impossible. You cannot be corrupted unless you have the power of coercion over other people. You cannot be corrupted unless you have the ability to affect other people's lives against their will. And that's the essence of collectivism. If we have established a system of individualism, which we describe on the website, then it doesn't make any difference who's president or who's king, even. Call him a king. If the king doesn't have the power, according to the Constitution, to offend the people or to take away their liberties or to redistribute their wealth or any of those things, then he's a nice guy and all that. He maybe puts a crown on his head, but he can't do any damage to society. So anyway, these are all issues that we've given a lot of thought to, and I'm glad you raised that, Eric, because we certainly don't want to create a new system down the line that's just as bad as the old one.
Excellent. Now, this idea or this word collectivism is kind of new to me, perhaps to many of our listeners. Could you just briefly define that?
Yeah, the whole ideological debate in the Western world is between two concepts, individualism versus collectivism. All these other words are meaningless. Nobody can define socialism, communism, Nazism. I mean, to our own satisfaction we can, but the guy that we're talking to may not have the same definition. Liberal versus conservative, left-wing versus right-wing. What do these words mean? So there are only two words that have any meaning, and that's collectivism versus individualism. Now, what is collectivism? We'll talk about that briefly. You might say that individualism is the opposite of collectivism on every point. One of the first tenets of collectivism that everybody recognizes is the concept that the group is more important than the individual.
Okay.
And that the individual must be sacrificed if necessary for the greater good of the greater number. Now, that's a common thought. I was taught that in school. I thought it was great when I read it and thought about it. Of course, we have democracy, right? We have to protect the majority against the majority gets its way because it's the majority. But then I realized, as I got deeper into it, that this is a trap. First of all, the group. What is the group? Well, the group, turns out, doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a group. You can't touch it. You can't feel it. You can't even... It doesn't exist. It's a concept. It's an abstraction. It's a word that implies many individuals. But the only real thing are the individuals. It's like the word forest. There's no such thing as a forest. There are only trees. So it's an abstraction for the concept of many trees. Well, it turns out that a group doesn't really exist. It's an abstraction for many people. The only real thing in the equation is people. And so if you sacrifice the rights of an individual for the assumed rights of the group, which doesn't even exist, it'd be a huge mistake because you've set in motion a system in which there are certain individuals who will claim that they speak on behalf of the group. And this is what Hitler did, this is what Stalin did, this is what Mao Zedong did, this is what all the dictators do, it's what our current level of politicians are doing too. They speak for the group, or the majority, and therefore the individual and the minority must be sacrificed if necessary for that greater good of the greater number. You know, I can't think of a better example to illustrate this than the example of democracy. There's a word that's much maligned. Most people today, when they use the word democracy, they think that means a system where individuals have rights and they control their own government. But historically, the word democracy doesn't have a good name at all. The founding fathers of our country spoke about that at some length, and they said that democracy was the worst possible form of government because it always destroys itself. It always leads to anarchy. It always leads to corruption. It leads to the mobs being manipulated by clever and eloquent leaders and so forth. The concept of majority rule is very popular, but think about it. A lynch mob. Here's a lynch mob in action. There's only one dissenting vote, and he's at the end of the rope. So, wait a minute, that's not right either. And now we come to the other concept. The founding fathers created what they called a republic. They had a meaning for that. The republic, in the classical sense, means majority rule, but with limits. And the limits are very important. The limits tell the majority what they may not do. There are certain things that even the majority may not do when it comes to violating the rights of individuals or the minority. Now we got a whole different animal here. There are certain things that the majority cannot do, and that's a republic. Well, this is, I don't know, I got off on that a little bit, but we're talking about individualism versus collectivism. Individualism respects the right of the individual and sees that as the ultimate center of focus on any social or political structure. The individual is it, and the whole purpose of government, as it even says in the Declaration of Independence, it says, purpose of government is to protect the right of the individual. To protect the right of the individual. Not to govern the individual, but to protect. It's a negative concept. And so that's what's built into our Constitution. That's the principle of individualism. But the principle of collectivism is to protect the group, whatever that is, which cannot be defined, is whoever the political leaders are at the time. They're the ones that will, I represent society. I represent the group. I represent the nation. And you, as an individual, have no rights if they come into conflict with the rights of the group. So we get into that, and you can go on deeper and deeper into it, but it's one of the essential differences. Another difference is that collectivists believe in coercion as a solution to all political and social problems, whereas individualists believe in freedom of choice. It's that simple. Collectivists will look around him and say, well, you know, if there is a problem, I know how we'll solve it. We'll pass a law. There ought to be a law. How many times have you heard that? You don't like somebody throwing cigarette butts on the sidewalk. There ought to be a law. We're going to force that guy not to throw cigarettes on the street. If not, we're going to throw him in jail. And that's a collectivist mind thinking. Individualist says, I don't like cigarettes on the street either, but I don't think there ought to be a law against it. I think we ought to campaign for it. We ought to educate people for it. But you can't throw people in jail for throwing cigarette butts on a street. You know, that sort of thing. And everybody says, well, I can justify this law because I don't like cigarette butts on the street. I can justify that law because I think that everybody should buckle up with seatbelts. And you keep adding all of these little things that I think it's better for you and everyone else to do this, 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 and this. The first thing you know, the passage of time, you've got thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of laws restricting your human action. At the end of that process is that you've been voting your chains on yourself. And you wonder, how come I don't have freedom anymore? There ought to be a law, you know? So those are just some of the things that we talk about on the Freedom Force website. And I think most people I run into, certainly 90% or higher, will come out of this thought process and they'll say, I think I'm really an individualist. Never thought about it before. But I'm not a collectivist.
Well, if I could just add a little bit to that, it seems to me that the Declaration of Independence, the teachings of Jesus Christ, the teachings of the Buddha, would all fall in on the side of the individualism, because they would protect the rights of the individual and consider the individual to be more important than the group. To that extent, I obviously am comfortable with that. Whereas you have Skull and Bones, in the book by Anthony C. Sutton about Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, where he talks about how they use the Hegelian dialectic, and they take the philosophy of Hegel, which is that the state is supreme over the individual. And then Sutton makes the point, well, who owns the state? They do.
That's it, exactly. Yeah, it's no different in essence from the theocracy, where the people have been convinced that God should rule the state. But who represents God? Well, happens to be a human being with a name.
Yeah, right.
So you've got two different paths to the same end result, and that is that an individual or an oligarchy of a few people will rule the entire society for some assumed power, either a divine power or, in this case, a mystical power of the group. and it all comes out the same, and that is that you and I lose our freedom.
Well, let me ask you this: what is the how do you keep individualism as a kind of a modus operandi from becoming anarchy?
Well, a true individualist believes that there is an area, a very clearly defined area for coercion. We all have the right to defend ourselves against, it boils down to this, we have a right to defend our lives, our liberty, and our property. Nobody, I don't think very many people would question that we have the right to use deadly force, if necessary, to defend our lives, our liberty, and our property. So therefore, we have that right to delegate to an entity which we unfortunately call government. I think that was a mistake that our founding fathers made when they drafted the Constitution, when they created our republic. They called it a government. They took that word from previous societies. I wish, in retrospect, they had used the word protectorate. Because if you use the word government, that implies that it should govern. But what they created was not something to govern. They created something to protect. And if we just get our head around that idea that the purpose of this thing we now call government really should be to protect our lives, our liberty, and our property, and you can use coercion for that purpose. You can have armies, and you can have police forces, and you can have jails, and so forth, in all those areas. Then you've got the basis, I think, for a very stable society. But once you go beyond that and say, well, the purpose of this thing we call government is not just to protect us, but to do things for us and to provide for us, now you've opened up a door that can never be closed, because that implies that you can, in order to help somebody over there, you've got to take the freedom away from somebody on the other side.
Yeah.
In order to provide for one, you must take from another. And now you get into that realm where everybody is reaching for the levers of power because they want to use that for their own benefit.
I'm not sure, though, that for reasons of national security and things of that sort, into protectorate is definitive enough. Does that make sense?
Well, there's no question that with any of these guidelines, you can have wordsmen who will twist the meaning of the word. National security, for example, is being used today to justify just about everything you can imagine. But the truth of the matter is, the people who are using the words in that fashion are lying. And you don't have to be very smart to see that they're lying. You can just look and see. In other words, there's no formula. I don't think you can use any words that are not capable of being distorted in some way to deceive. But when you come right down to it, and you say that the purpose of a protectorate or a government is to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens, you've made a huge step forward in delineating the areas in which the lies can be said. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
That, because it restricts the areas tremendously. Now, if you don't do that, then you can say the purpose of this thing called government is to do anything we want it to do. You've got a real problem on your hands.
Well, you know what? It sounds like we could just keep going on and on here. And maybe we could take it up again in the future, if you'd like. And
most of these issues are discussed at quite a bit of length on our Freedom Force website.
Yeah, we'll study up on that before our next interview, hopefully. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think you'll find a lot to think about there.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very illuminating, interesting, and inspiring as well.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. I appreciate that. And Melody, you've been a gem to let me talk all this time. I'm surprised you let me do that.
Not at all. You're great. So, thank you very much, Ed. And
all right, thank you.
Thanks, Ed. I'm looking forward to checking in on the site there.
Okay, I'll be talking to you later.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.